The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
Part two of the two-part episode.
Today's guest is Rear Admiral Mattis, a native of Fullerton, California. Admiral Mattis graduated with distinction from the U.S. Naval Academy and went on to study as a Fitzgerald Scholar at Oxford. Over his career, he has served as a submariner, a nuclear engineer, a ballistic missile officer, and later as a leader in the space and information warfare. He has commanded at sea, supported civil military operations in Iraq, and led Navy relief efforts in Los Angeles during the COVID-19 pandemic. Most recently, he set up Navy Space Command as its director and now serves as Director of Strategic Effects for U.S. Naval Forces Europe and Africa, and as Commander of Task Force 66. His career reflects the Navy's evolution across undersea, space, and information domains, and the human dimension of leadership across them all.
I had a stutter growing up, and it helped me to like read stuff out loud to kind of overcome that. It definitely helped me for that. Who do you think plays the best Falstaff, film-wise?
I can only say my Shakespeare professor at the Naval Academy, Professor David Allard White, who recently passed away and who I did my senior thesis project of. And it's sort of ironic. I talked about Michael Jasperson, my Shakespeare professor at the Naval Academy. He and David White were rivals at the Naval Academy to some degree, great friends, but rivals. And Jasperson retired and handed me over to David White. And David Allard White, by far, was the best Falstaff I've ever seen. And he loved that part more than anything else. But that's who I'm going with on that. So again, just a great man. And I miss him tremendously. Again, he was phenomenal tutor, mentor of mine at the Naval Academy and just a great friend. And has recently passed away.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but there's a podcast I listened to. It's interviewing about the time period that we're talking about. And I think it was Tyler Cowen, and he asked, like, who plays the best, you know, whatever. And they mentioned a movie that Orson Welles is in, who plays a Falstaff character. Like, it deviates a lot from the material. But I heard he does a really good job, apparently, bringing him into that scene. Towards the end of his life, Orson Welles, he's a portly fellow. So he plays it really, really well, apparently. And it's currently on my queue. I kind of want to stick with what we're talking about here for book-wise. Is there any recent book or thinker that you have found that has recently shaped or reshaped or maybe you think differently about like your worldview or how you approach things?
Yeah, one of my all-time favorite authors is Malcolm Gladwell.
So Blink, right?
Yeah, Blink. Let me go through them here. Outliers is another one. And then it's the other big one that he's known for is...
Not Freakonomics.
No, but it's along those lines. In any case, it'll come to me. Gladwell really does an amazing job of having you understand your process and understand your bias and understand your interoperability with sort of the universe in a way that no other author that I've read really resonates quite as well with me. And so a couple of things from Gladwell that just stick with me tremendously deeply. Number one, Blink. Gladwell, and I read Blink a little bit before I went to Iraq in 2008, 2009, and I credit Blink for allowing me to trust my instincts in a way that I never would have before.
For the listeners who haven't read Blink, what is Blink about?
Blink is this notion that your brain is so powerful that the more you analyze, the more data you have, you actually end up confusing your brain over understanding something that you might understand in literally just a blink. Now, that said, the other thing that Blink teaches you is that there are standard biases. You're biased towards tall people, for example. You're going to want to believe tall people more than short people. So you have to calibrate for these biases. And he also talks about, you know, just other ways that you can sort of work bias out of your thinking. Blind auditions is an example. We currently have the American Idol version where they're in the chairs that turn around, whatever that is, The Voice. That's based on sort of this blank concept that the way you really get to meritocracy in music is that you don't look at the person generating the music. You listen to it because that's the purest form of it. And your eyes will bias you based on other aspects that will take away from the purity of the voice. And so Blink is really about trusting your gut, understanding your bias, and calibrating for that. And the thing that I love about Blink is that it really taught me that you can have a process to really understand something. Your brain is incredibly powerful. Once you understand your process and you're able to use it for you. So for example, your unconscious can, what he calls thin slice problem sets and break them down for you. And so, again, everyone has a different kind of way of doing this. For me, interestingly enough, if I think deeply about a problem that is vexing to me before I go to bed and let my brain work on it at night.
Percolate.
That's right. And then when I'm in the shower the next morning, think about it, I will have a deep insight come to me. It is mind-boggling how well this works. And I never would have believed it or trusted it until I read that book, understood my own process, and was able to benefit from that. And some of my deepest insights come from allowing my brain to chew on a problem overnight. And then, again, in an activity that I'm busy doing something else, I will think about that problem set, and an idea will come to me that I have no idea where it came from, but it came out of my conscious, you know, thinking about it, grinding on it, and connected dots in a way that I couldn't connect. And to me, that has been an incredibly powerful and meaningful thing. The other thing that comes out of outliers is really this notion of 10,000 hours. You are an expert when you've put 10,000 hours into something, and you have an intuition on that thing. And so if you have 10,000 hours of work into something, you know it well, you should trust it well. It's interesting for me. I've worked on engineering projects for a significant portion of my career. I certainly have my 10,000 hours in, and I have an immediate intuition on most things when it comes to engineering problem sets around the remote commanding of vehicles, because that was really my expertise. I've just worked the problem sets every which way you can for a lot of years, and I've failed and understood designs over the years, and I've implemented and operationalized lots of capabilities along those lines. So I have good instincts when it comes to that. Other people don't have any of that knowledge and expertise, and their instincts are terrible. And you have to be able to differentiate when you think you've got good instincts based on your 10,000 hours or not. It's also, as a mariner, it's a similar thing. If you've got the time at sea, you see problems, you have deeper insights as well out of those things. One of the other books I love from Gladwell is David and Goliath. That's another fantastic story, but it's about underdogs and the power of underdogs. Again, very meaningful work. And I still can't think of the other one that has to do with sort of the economics of it, but we could look it up later. Any case, love me some Gladwell. Incredible author. The books are ones that I can reread again and again and again and regain those insights again and again and again. It's a well that I go back to often. I do love his podcasts as well. He's sort of fun to listen to. And he does have some throwaway books. There's one book, it's got the dog is in the name of it. But again, it's sort of a rehashing of his New York Times articles or something. It's not really a focus book. So Malcolm Gladwell is sort of notoriously good at cashing in on his ideas. And so there is a sort of a commercial piece to him that you have to kind of take. But his deeper thoughts and his early works, I think, are incredible. The Tipping Point was the other book about spreading messages and when they take off virally. And again, I think his insights in psychology and sociology and where those meet across society are deep and meaningful. So again, if I'm giving broad recommendations or giving people books generally, I like to give people Malcolm Gladwell because I think there's always something to learn and gain from him. Otherwise, I'm usually reading biographies or histories. I don't have a whole lot of time for fiction, but other fiction books that the one other kind of fiction that I will get into is I do like to look at science fiction that is looking at the future of warfare that is meaningful. And the best author in that arena that I've come across, and again, it just helps you think through future of warfare, is an author. It's a made-up name called F.X. Holden. And he's got an amazing series of books that have you think through geopolitics, tactical execution, cyber warfare, space warfare, naval and land warfare in different ways and different times. It's sort of phenomenal. The series that I like best out of him in thinking about this, I think there's one called Bering Strait, strangely enough, which is about the special base that the U.S. puts in the Bering Strait. And it sort of is a war between Russia and the United States. Got a lot of autonomy and crazy aircraft in it. There's another one that's about war, which I think it's called Okinawa, maybe, and it's about the U.S. going to war with Japan, and China's on our side, I think. It's a weird setup. Somehow we go to war with Japan in this thing, and China's in a weird spot. And the last one is, I think, called Orbital. And again, there's a common character through all three. She's an Australian F-35 pilot that is just a badass that ends up like working for DARPA. And she's like one of the coolest characters I've encountered. F.X. Holden's one of my go-tos.
You talked about a little bit about, I actually like the ending on that last part with regards to technology. Things that I've been reading about and hearing about is AI, artificial intelligence becoming more of a general purpose technology, where it's becoming, I think the idea of AI, people say it, and it's almost something like exotic. But we've had these systems for a while, and even in the military, I mean, Aegis has some elements of AI, right? You know, Sense, Comprehend, Act, like we have a bunch of systems that have that. But from your perspective, where do you see autonomy and artificial intelligence going from the military perspective?
A lot of people ask me, and obviously, and I think you're going to link it in your show notes here, just did a speech at the Naval Postgraduate School on the work I do for the Navy in Europe and Africa around drones and my Task Force 66 and 166 and support to Ukraine in the maritime. And a lot of people ask me in that context, do I think that unmanned systems, robotic and autonomous systems, machine learning, artificial intelligence, I think, are we in an evolution of that capability or a revolution in that capability? My answer is generally that in Ukraine, what we're seeing is the evolution of that technology. And the main reason for that is because we have first-person view or FPV operators on it, one-on-one, maybe one-on-two, one human for one or two drone kind of basis. And in that kind of world, you cannot scale to get the amount of effect that you need in a major way that the U.S. military in a potential conflict with like a peer adversary of a Russia or China, which you really need to do. It's sufficient for Ukraine to be quite effective in the Black Sea, but not sufficient to defend Taiwan, for example. And so one has to be careful with these terms. First off, artificial intelligence only works if you have machine learning right. Machine learning right only works if you have very curated data sets. Curated data sets only work if you have very well understood processes. Very well understood processes only work if you have manual processes that you over time have built out, systematized in many ways, put algorithms towards, et cetera. So you're really building on years and more rigorous discipline with data. I think the fundamentals for all of these things is garbage in equals garbage out. And so AI, ML, all of that goes back to, do I have the right data sets, the right curated data sets? Have I fed that into the machine learning process the right way to inform my artificial intelligence appropriately to allow it to give me, I would say it's more limited in what it's able to do. I don't know that we're at the point of having general purpose AI yet. I think we have very tailored AI that's able to do very specific things and recognize very specific problems and apply very specific solutions to those problems. General AI is not something I think we're close to, although many people are afraid we're going to fall into that tomorrow. I think that AI hallucinations are a good example of that, where essentially AI doesn't know and you can sort of feed it information and it will provide feedback loops to you that can actually steer you into great delusion. And so AI is really based on having these really curated data sets, really well understood processes that can feed and grow and develop. And it requires enormous amounts of data as well. And so if you don't have large volumes of curated data sets, then again, you're really at risk. So going back to your question, or going back to my answer to your question, which is evolutionary or revolutionary, I think autonomous systems, machine learning, AI will be revolutionary when we can have one operator and many, many drones via autonomy. And those drones have things like automatic target recognition, where they're able to autonomously identify the appropriate target and then figure out how to do collaborative autonomy to take down that target with minimal human operator on the loop. And so in the loop versus on the loop, the operator being directly involved in the decision-making versus the operator watching the decision-making process and being able to take action to stop something rather than keep it going. It's almost like command by negation, like we have in a composite warfare construct where all the warfare commanders are just going to do your thing and the OTC will command by negation. If they doesn't want you to do something, he'll say no. Otherwise, he'll just keep going. That is an operator on the loop. That's going to allow us to move quickly. Again, from an OODA loop standpoint, it'll allow you to observe, orient, decide, and then act appropriately. It's going to give you the bandwidth to actually observe and truly orient if you're in the middle of taking action as you observe, there's no way to really orient in the way that making a decision is valuable. And so the goal is ultimately to raise the operator to be on the loop and have very well-trained systems that have very disciplined data sets that allow us to execute very narrow AI to allow certain functionality in very powerful ways that we're very confident of. I think we're working towards that. We're not there yet. If we can get artificial intelligence and machine learning to operate that way, I think this could be a revolutionary event that occurs in the history of warfare, but we're not there yet. Ukraine is clearly evolutionary. This drone warfare thing, I think, has the potential to be revolutionary, but it all goes back to, do we have the disciplined data sets that we really need to be able to drive the decision making that we really need? Do we have the processes refined well enough to do that? So I'm not worried about general purpose AI yet. I'm not worried about AI taking over or having that Skynet moment. What I am worried about is that we are afraid of AI to the point that we are going to try and keep the operator in the loop in events that they simply won't have time to respond to, and that our adversaries will continue to develop AI regardless of the errors, regardless of the potential for civilian casualties or potential to hit the wrong ship or the potential to shoot down the wrong aircraft. And as a result, we have put our own operators in the middle of these loops to provide a level of human decision-making that is overwhelmed by the operation. And so to give you an example, I would say if you were to look at human decision-making processes, you will find that it is probably more errorful than if you put a very well-constructed list of things and you let a machine do that. The best of both worlds in my book is when you have an operator who is on the loop monitoring the decisions and making specific changes around where the autonomy or where the artificial intelligence or where the machine learning processes are going that they can curate and make a decision on. So for example, if we have really good understanding of synthetic aperture radar images of ships, it is highly probable that artificial intelligence will be able to tell whether it's a combatant or a merchant. I don't believe I need a human operator making every one of those decisions. What I need is a percentage of which the artificial intelligence threshold is really good. So at 85% confidence, we could say that's pretty high confidence. Anything below that, I'm going to go look at. Anything above that, I'm just going to let go through the process and say and auto-determine that that's a warship. And those to me are how we ought to be doing things. We ought to be saving time for operator to go interrogate. But no, I don't think that artificial intelligence is there yet. I think it's really about how we implement it in a meaningful way to offload the operator, to prevent them from having cognitive deficiencies around decision-making or overload. And we get them into a mode where they can literally decide where close calls can actually be elevated into goes for fires.
I think there's a mystique right now around AI that's slowly being eroded in a positive way in regards to some of these articles that I mentioned, but AI becoming a normal technology, meaning like we're so accustomed to it now, it loses that kind of mystic quality. And to what you said, your point that it's not at that level quite where, even if it does actually meet that, where we go through a worst case scenario for artificial general intelligence. There's an article that I read and talks about how technology gets integrated into society, and it takes a long time. As you mentioned before, garbage in, garbage out. If you have processes, then you're producing like a terrible output. And I think it's important for people to understand like pumps, electricity, steam engines. Like I think the first use case I read was a coal mine to get like the water out.
Yeah.
And it took like decades for that to translate to like the looms and all this other stuff, you know. And I think we're really in the early stages for that. And there's something you touched on earlier as well, sir, in regards to like coming out of your mental model, especially here in California or early California, the Bay Area, it's very easy to get wrapped up into this feedback loop where we have this new technology, they're trying to sell it, we're the customer, you're trying to buy it too. And how do you differentiate between what could be a good tool versus what the tool actually can do, given our current infrastructure, given our current system? And I think we're learning how to integrate these into our processes, our tactics, procedures. And as you mentioned, you know, I think for Ukraine, you see that with these smaller conflicts. And I think even prior to Ukraine, the Azerbaijan-Armenia war, that was really, I think, the catalyst for drone warfare. And I would submit, not a lot of people talked about it.
No. It was really early on. It was in an obscure area. It had dramatic effects and a dramatic turnaround, but was not well understood at the time. But when you go back and look at it, you're like, wow, this is really tremendous that you had this, the force that was not expected to win won because they applied drones in a more effective manner. Again, not with a lot of artificial intelligence, largely manually, but it was a surprising novel kind of warfare. I do want to go back to one thing you said about with respect to technology taking time to be absorbed into the human mind. I would argue, and I'll tie this back to the Shakespeare discussion we had earlier. One of the crazy things about Shakespeare is he grew up in a divided world. He grew up in a medieval world and in a Renaissance world. And his lifetime saw the transition between those two. If you think about Silicon Valley today and you think about Shakespeare's era, what was Silicon Valley in Shakespeare's era? Any idea where that was?
Silicon Valley as it is now?
Yes. At the innovation center, the technology center of the world in the Middle Ages. What brought us out of the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance? So the actual answer, in my opinion, is Mainz, Germany, where the printing press, the Gutenberg printing press, was invented. This is right outside of Wiesbaden. I do a lot of work out of Wiesbaden with Security Assistance Group Ukraine. And I happened to know Mainz pretty well.
Very good point. That was a huge technological...
That's right. But what it did... Again, it took about 100 years, but it essentially took books out of the hands of handwritten monks and very wealthy people, and it made it available to the general population. It took about 100 years, but it is what led to the Renaissance and what led to the Reformation and what led to an entire shift in the political society of the entire world. And like I said, it took 100, 150 years for books to propagate out there. I would argue there's a very similar parallel with the amount of information exploding in society in a very similar way between the analog age, which, again, some of us grew up in, and the digital age, which we exist in now. And that one of the things that makes Shakespeare unique is he grew up in a medieval age where he was literally watching these medieval mystery plays that he turns into these Shakespearean history plays that have this medieval narrative through them. And the Renaissance world, where a world where everyone's reading books, where drama is open to the general public in the theater in London, and everyone can see these things. And it's not just about the Bible, but it's about all of these different topics. A human experience, it just explodes in an incredible way. And I would argue that something similar happened really between the 1980s and 2020. But in reality, it happened very quickly around 2000. And we went from an analog age to a digital age almost overnight. And it didn't take 100 years. It was probably closer to 10 years. And so the amount of knowledge that we had available to us, or at least I had available to me as a child 50 plus years ago, consisted of going to the library or looking at an encyclopedia. My kids have had, since their youngest years, the ability to go on Google and type in a question and get an answer. And they've never had to look it up or read it in a book or go figure out where it is in a library. They've literally had it at their fingertips. And that explosion of information and the likewise driving the technology around that information has been absorbed into society in a shorter period of time than in any other period in history. And I would say geometrically shorter than what we saw in the Renaissance. But if you look at society 200 years ago and up until maybe the 1950s, you'll see that it was about the same. It was an agrarian society. Industry was coming along, but the way we taught our children was roughly the same. Like, it would look the same to somebody in 1950 that it would look to somebody in 1850 and maybe 1750. The way you learned, the way you grew up, the way you got your food, the way you did everything was very, very similar over hundreds of years, probably going back to, again, the early Renaissance phases. However, what we have seen in the last 40 or 50 years has been revolutionary. The way you get your food today, the way that you decide anything today, the way that you get information, the way that you go to school has all been revolutionized in a way that we haven't seen since the disruption of the Middle Ages and the serfs and all of that, to a way that is more common and has been in sort of agrarian early industrial society. So my thesis is, Shakespeare grew up in this window where he lived in a half medieval, half Renaissance world. At least for me, I've grown up in a half analog, half digital world. And it's at these sort of cusp of what I would consider like an hourglass, right? It has that hourglass shape where all this information flows into a funnel and all of a sudden it explodes. And I think that's sort of what we're seeing in this analog era, sort of coming to an end, the funnel narrowing down, and now this digital world is exploding in an incredible way. In the same way the medieval era sort of funneled in and then exploded in this Renaissance in a very different way as well. But I believe we're at this sort of hourglass neck point right now that is rapidly exploding out in society. And maybe that's that neck down has already happened and we're well in the expansion at this point. So again, only ever happens maybe once every 500 or 1,000 years. And we have lived through that, at least in my lifetime. And so it's sort of fascinating to see those parallels between Shakespeare's era and our era. But I would argue that the way that we see technology happening is so much faster, exponentially faster than anything we've seen in society up to this point.
It's a very exciting, sobering environment in which we live in. And I think it's important that we are aware of history, because we need to look back on that to understand how we can move forward given our current constraints. Because you live life once, but it tends to repeat, you know, I think, in regards to parallels to the past. I think with that, Admiral, I think we can end on that note. And I really appreciate our conversation, our discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, Admiral Mattis, thanks, sir.
Hey, appreciate it. Great to be here, and thanks for the conversation. I don't think this went anywhere in the direction we were thinking, but it was super interesting, and I really enjoyed it. So thanks for your time.
Yes, sir. Appreciate it. All right. Thank you so much once again for your podcast, and thank you all.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.